Our second case this morning is United States against Ayala. Counsel for defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, may it please the court. When you peel back the layer of an onion, it stinks. When you peel back the layer of this drug testing policy at Davis Mountain Air Force Base, it stinks too. And the reason why is the purpose of this policy is to circumvent the spirit and the protections that are found in the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and MRE 313 when it comes to inspections. And the reason why that you've got to kind of drill down and peel away the layers of this onion is you need to look at how this policy came about and how it was implemented. We have a staff judge advocate who provided a written legal advice to his commander, his wing commander. And in that legal advice, he says, I propose that you basically implement this reinspection policy. I've attached the memorandum for you to sign, which has the policy included. But let me give you all the reasons why that you should implement this policy. And that's really where these layers start to unravel for this
particular. Now, it's fair to say that the SJA's primary purpose, if not sole purpose, for the policy was for military discipline purposes. But how are we to know that's in fact the commander's?
When you take When you take a look at what the fine distinction between an inspection and a search would be, a commander is going to most likely be relying on his legal advisor to provide him the proper advice. In a case such as this, the commander's
proper advice, but that doesn't mean he buys his reasoning. Isn't there a presumption of regularity here? You know, the reg, or whatever you want to call it, is fair on its face. How much can we dig behind the fact that it's fair on its face and is presumed to be regular?
I think this court has to dig on its face based on the perfunctory affidavit that was provided by the wing commander in response to the motion, and that's found in the joint appendix at page 57.
But what in the military judge's ruling suggests that we should be doing that? What's wrong with the military judge's ruling other than that you disagree with the result?
Beyond the obvious of disagreeing with the result, there's a couple of statements that the military judge made in his ruling which kind of caused this court to pause. For example, he focused on that there being only the sole purpose to obtain evidence, and that was not the commander's intent, was the military judge's finding. However, if you take a look at the dissent in Taylor, where it talks about whether something is a sole purpose, it doesn't necessarily, primary purpose doesn't mean sole purpose or exclusive purpose. And I think when you're faced with the facts of this particular case, where we have a purpose, which is what the staff judge advocate has said, we need to get more evidence to get these guys to plead guilty. And then you've got this wing commander who never provided an explanation, was very cursory.
But would you agree with the statement that both what the staff judge advocate said in his memorandum, which is that with respect to the evidentiary usefulness of follow-on your analysis, that those are true statements but not a valid purpose for an inspection?
They are true. Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that statement.
Okay. And would you also agree that what the commander actually issued as a memorandum does not identify those purposes, but basically identifies purposes that support an inspection?
And I think
in the memorandum.
Yes, Your Honor, in the actual policy.
And that the affidavit that he wrote later said that was the purpose of the policy. The purpose of the policy was to ensure security, military fitness, and good order and discipline.
And if there's two prongs that I'd like to kind of engage with you on that one.
That is what he said.
That is what the commander did, in fact, say in those documents.
So in order for us to say that, no, this was all a subterfuge, we would need to conclude, contrary to what the military judge found, that he was lying in his affidavit.
Not necessarily that he was lying in his affidavit.
That it was a subterfuge, that what he said in his affidavit was factually not true.
I think it would more go to kind of looking at lack of knowledge of the law and lack of candor, as this court recognized in Jackson, when it discussed, well, we had the officer who authorized the inspection who testified, and he testified that he knew the materials could be used in a court-martial or Article 15. And this court said that forthright testimony basically showed to us a candor aspect of why, what played a factor into this particular commander in authorizing the inspection. And that any other answer from Captain Lamport would have reflected either ignorance of the law or a lack of candor.
Well, counsel, is the affidavit submitted by the commander contradictory to the SJA's recommendation? That is, I understand that the SJA said things that the commander didn't say, but are they wholly inconsistent? Or is there a consistency there with an incompleteness?
I think they are wholly inconsistent for a variety of reasons.
Well, if they're wholly inconsistent, then doesn't that raise the question of whether, in this case, the commander was lying when the commander submitted that affidavit? That is, if the two could be reconciled, there might be a reason for it. Other than lying, but if they can't be reconciled, what else is there here?
And again, I think it goes back to lack of knowledge of the law, where the SJA presented the commander with the initial policy letter that was attached to the legal advice. So the SJA included basically this magic language, and as this court noted in Jackson, that a commander can't simply wave a magic wand and incant the magic words to justify something as an inspection. And I think that's the situation that this court is faced with here. We have the SJA who focused on it being a search. He even went so far as to call Bickle a search. And I would turn this court's attention to paragraph 5 of the SJA's memorandum, where he said the court reasoned that the second year analysis was essentially a continuation of the search. So you have a commander who is a layperson, who is probably not as up to speed as the finest.
Is there anything that prevented defense counsel from asking the commander these questions?
There is not. And, Your Honor, in candor to the court, we understand that that area of the record of trial is not as fully developed, which is why we've asked for the alternative relief to possibly take a look at one, either to jury hearing or remanding this case back to the lower court to use their fact-finding power.
What do you need a debate hearing for? That this is not something that arose after trial. It's not something that arose that the parties wouldn't have been aware for. How can you have a debate hearing about a matter which was litigated at trial, in which the parties had the opportunity to present evidence? Have we ever held, I guess this is a question, have we ever held that a debate hearing is appropriate to go into matter that was litigated at trial when the parties had the opportunity to present evidence on it?
That I'm not entirely aware of, Your Honor, but what the reason is...
Well, let's skip the debate hearing then for the moment. You're welcome to come back to it in your argument. But my question goes to then, at trial, who bore the burden at a particular time? First, when the motion was made to suppress the evidence, who bore the burden at that stage?
Initially, the defense bore the burden to bring the motion, and then it was up to the government to show by the preponderance of the evidence that it was for the primary purpose, was for inspection purposes.
Well, was it preponderance of the evidence, or was it by clear and convincing evidence? What part of Rule 313 is at issue here?
When you take a look at 313, where you start to reach that clear and convincing evidence burden is when those three conditions are raised for whether it's an inspection or a subterfuge for a search. So that's where that triggers that clear and convincing. However, you could take a look at, and there's nothing to prevent this court, when those three are lacking, it still can be found to be a search, and then it would be using that lower standard.
So where are we here? Is this a matter in which the judge was required to apply the clear and convincing evidence standard, or is your point that the judge could simply rely on preponderance of the evidence at that point?
The judge could have relied on a preponderance of evidence, and the military judge acknowledged that and then went on to say that he applied the clear and convincing standard regardless.
Okay. So now we have that standard being applied, and we have the government puts on the evidence of the affidavit. Why isn't that evidence of the affidavit sufficient at that point, absent anything else, to allow the government to prevail?
And when you take a look, I think, at Hamilton, which is one of the cases that the Air Force Court, the government, has relied on to say that an SJA's vice does not automatically attribute to the commander. In that particular case, the majority discussed the case Rosser a little bit and did a comparison of the Rosser case, and where it talked about whether a military judge should be relying on such basically perfunctory affidavits or testimony or conclusions from a potential witness in a motion, especially when the interest and the fairness of trial are at play. And I think that's the situation that we have here.
Why can't the judge rely on that when the judge knows that the defense has ample opportunity to obtain evidence from the SJA and the commander and hasn't done so in this case?
Because I think that's part of where the military judge erred in drawing the conclusions of this case without asking for that, because Rosser says that it's incumbent on the military judge to basically make that sufficient inquiry and to not rely on perfunctory matters such as this.
So it's the obligation, you say the error here was that the military judge didn't call the SJA or the commander to testify?
The military judge has that burden to rely on sufficient information. And in this case, when you have an affidavit, and such a perfunctory affidavit, and that's the only evidence that the government used to refute the defense motion, that calls into question then the fairness of the proceedings and how this might go. Another concern is, and that's not fully developed in the record, is how this affidavit came about. If you look at the title of the affidavit, it says, Affidavit in Support of Government's Response to Defense's Motion to Suppress. It's highly unlikely that a layperson and a commander is going to know to throw all of that at the top of the affidavit. And then the affidavit does nothing to address the concerns or does not do anything to repudiate the SJA's advice that was provided to him in the implementation. Well,
so are you saying that the judge has a positive duty basically to prod the defense counsel into doing more?
I think when you're looking at something with a fundamental fairness in the Fourth Amendment, you need to err on the side of caution, and the judge didn't do that.
Well, is that what you're saying?
In essence, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
There should be something.
How do you answer the government's contention that what you're asking us to do is relook a finding of fact?
I wouldn't say it necessarily relook at a finding of fact, but when you're looking at the military judge's conclusion of whether something was an inspection of search, that's something that this court looks at de novo. And so there's an opportunity to go back and relook at the ultimate decision.
Well, that's a question of law. Is it an inspection? Is it a search? That's a question of law. But the question of who influenced whom and what was in the mind of the commander, is that not a question of fact? Can we relook that?
When you're looking at a determination, I would say what you're saying, Your Honor, goes to whether the primary purpose, and that is treated as a conclusion of fact that this court would look at whether the military judge abused the discretion. And I think
whether the judge abused his discretion is a matter of law.
But as far as clearly erroneous, and I apologize,
yeah.
I misspoke. And I think where that goes into play is something that I highlighted earlier for this court, where the military judge talked about the sole purpose. There was no sole purpose of it being to obtain evidence, and that was a finding of fact that the military judge made, which I think, based on the facts of this case, you could say it is clearly erroneous and allow this court to revisit that particular aspect of the judge's ruling. As far as what we're dealing with here, and again, going back to a little bit earlier, the question about reconciling the SJA's memorandum to the policy letter from the Wing Commander and how these two things are connected. We have two documents that are so diametrically opposed and based on two different principles of the law. One is a search and one is an inspection. And we have nothing from the commander to ever say that he repudiated and never took into account the fact that the staff judge advocate misadvised him as to the purpose of this policy and really ultimately why this purpose and why this policy was put into place. But when you take a look at things that Colonel Pelquin said to Colonel Lafcombe, it's really quite telling. But the policy will secure a second test, and if that test is positive, then we have evidence of two positive results available for trial. I mean, those are pretty heady things that you're expecting a layperson to be able to distinguish and know and understand rulings such as Bickel and the interpretation of this court of 313B to be able to say in those 2 days between the SJA submitting the memo and the policy actually being signed, that this commander was able to exercise such independent discretion to completely do away with the taint that was kind of brought forward to him by Colonel Pelequin's memo. And I do see that my time is almost concluded.
You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Evron, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Matt Osborne, and I, along with Mr. Gerald R. Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. The military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion in finding that appellant's additional year analysis were conducted for a permissible purpose. The installation commander's retesting policy had a proper primary purpose to ensure security, military fitness, and good order and discipline. And it's for these reasons.
Limits. Is that it in terms of the policy? How many reinspections can you go into this thing before you lose the original tail, head, dog?
I would think, according to the policy and according to Bickel, until the year analysis comes back negative.
So even if it becomes obvious after the 100th in a row failure that this guy is going to get court-martialed, it doesn't matter because the policy was always just keep on reinspecting. And so as long as they mouthed the right words at the beginning, you can reinspect till you have all the evidence in the history of the world.
Presumably, yes. And
okay, let me try another one on you then. So you're inspecting a room inspection, you find a meth lab, your handy dandy meth lab. Instead of the mash still, you have a meth lab. And so, no problem, you're going to reinspect because what we're really worried about is that room's tidy. And we'll come back and inspect for the meth lab again. No problem with that. You can't convert a normal reinspection into a primary purpose law enforcement search.
Sure, it can convert. But the point, and the point this court made in Bickel was the purpose of these reinspections are kind of like a building inspection. We're going to go to a building, and there's something wrong with the building. So a month later, we're going to come back and see if that was fixed. And if it's not fixed, we're going to come back a month later and see if it's fixed then.
And you don't think in the context of your analysis that things guaranteed to be going to a court-martial about the 19th time?
Well, one would say hopefully about the 19th time.
You want to see if there's any limit to your argument, because otherwise you just write a policy, say everything's for good order and discipline and morale and so on, and we'll re-inspect till the cows come home. And there's no end to how much evidence you can seize. Well, and under what circumstances, because everything ultimately, you know, reinspection, of course.
Sure. Could there become a point? Sure, I'm sure there could.
Can you describe in this that case, point in appellate language, please? Understanding that you will describe it in a manner that will preserve your position.
Sure.
But I want to know if there's some outer limit to how many times you can reinspect someone before it's obvious you're gathering evidence for the biggest court-martial in the history of the world.
I would say, pursuant to Bickel, no, there's not, for purposes of your analysis. But with regards to this case, where we're talking about three, we're certainly not at that point.
Okay. What are we to make of the rather interesting sequence of events here? SJA goes to the commander with this missive. 2 days later, bingo, policy pops out, saying nothing of the reasons in the missive. We all know how staff work's done in the United States Air Force and the other services. You don't provide the old man a recommendation and say, okay, boss, you do something with this if you feel like it. You give him something to sign. He may not like it. He may change it. But you give him something to sign. Because commanders aren't used to writing their own stuff.
Absolutely.
He wants a staff summary sheet, and he wants something to sign. Okay, 2 days elapsed. Now, what are we to make of that sequence?
Well, I think what we're to make of it is exactly what Judge Ryan, you asked earlier, the question is, if we're going to refute the judge's findings of fact, is do we basically have to call the commander here a liar? And the answer to that question is undoubtedly yes. Because here's what we have. We have that policy letter that says, this is why I'm doing it. It's for security, military fitness, and good order and discipline. And then, 19 months later, when he, when the commander does an affidavit, and this is after he's retired from the Air Force, 19 months later, he puts in his affidavit that reaffirms them, that says, yes, this is why I did it. So basically, I mean, the military judge would have had to find, with the evidence on the record, that he lied twice, that this was just a big sham, just to, go after these drug users.
Would you agree that the SJA's memorandum, which lists the prosecutorial or law enforcement reasons, and that was the only reason that was given to the commander, is that some evidence? It's certainly not primary, but is that some evidence that the purpose of this was for prosecutorial reason?
It should raise some flags, absolutely.
Well, then, but what do we do with paragraph 14 of the military judge's findings that says that there was no evidence that the air analysis reinspection policy was implemented for the sole purpose to obtain evidence for criminal prosecutions?
Oh, I didn't mean to say that the SJA memo serves as evidence that it's back. It just serves as a reason to question why it was done. So,
why wouldn't it be evidence? I mean, you may not think it's very strong evidence, but I mean, it's there, and that's the only recommendation that, as far as we know, the commander had, and the burden here is on the government to show that it was an inspection. But the burden isn't on the defense to bring this up.
But the SJA's memo is not evidence of why it was done. The SJA's memo is evidence of why the SJA thinks it should be done.
The SJA's memo is all that we have at this point as to why the commander did what he did. There's no testimony from the commander in the record. The government didn't put on any testimony that said, I looked at this and I thought, no, I'm going to adopt it for the reasons in the policy itself. We don't have that.
Well, we have an affidavit from him.
Well, we have an affidavit that was prepared by the same SJA, probably, that wrote the memorandum.
That's a lot of assumptions that aren't in the record. But, I mean, what we have is his affidavit that's 19 months later that says, this is why I did it. So there is his evidence as to why he did it, in addition to the policy letter that we have. And it's important to keep in mind that affidavit was not questioned or objected to by the defense at trial. So, you know, it is the government's burden by a preponderance of evidence to put evidence on that this was done.
But, I mean, here we do have a conflict, as has been pointed out by Judge Stuckey here, between the two documents. Wouldn't it have been helpful, since the government does have the burden, to present the commander to say, yes, this is the memorandum I got, but I didn't follow that advice. I didn't listen to that advice. I disregarded that advice. Where do we know that?
In a perfect case, could they have done that? Yes. But did the requirements of the law require them to do that? No, because they're under a preponderance of the evidence standard.
You see what the problem in this case is that we have this memorandum, and it lists the from the SJA that lists all of these reasons why they should adopt the policy. He then has prepared the policy, and in that policy he gives the reasons for the adoption of the policy, and they are completely inconsistent. None of the real reasons that he has given the commander are found in the policy, or vice versa. Now, isn't that troubling at all to the government?
Not when you have the affidavit from the commander, who reaffirms what he says. And in that affidavit, he says, this is why I did it. So, once again, I mean, we're deciding whether or not he's lying or not is basically the issue. And the record just doesn't support that. Now, the other part is that, you know, What the appellant would have this court believe is that the commander is basically the puppet in this case, that he's the potted plant, the rubber stamp of SJ's bringing me something. I'm a lay person, I think is how the appellant's counsel put it, so he doesn't know any better and he's just going to sign it. But, you know, this isn't a second lieutenant flight commander who's been on active duty for 6 months. And we're talking about a 20-plus year active duty colonel who's not only a wing commander but a special court-martial convening authority.
Who completely ignores the advice of his SJA.
And that's been known to happen.
Now, he wasn't the commander at the time charges were preferred in this case, was he?
That is correct.
What is the effect of a subsequent commander with respect to this memorandum? Do you understand what I'm saying? There's a new commander, the person who preferred charges. Presumably, or I'm going to ask you, do we know if that person was presented with the SJA's letter discussing the prosecutorial assistance that re-inspections would give?
If there's no evidence on the record of.
And how do we treat a memorandum from one commander when there's a new commander? Do we have a legal theory that they've looked at it, that they don't look at it? What do we do?
Correct. And that was something that was addressed at the lower court. That was an argument that was brought by the appellant at the lower court in a legal and factual sufficiency realm. And an argument that was brought to this court in the legal sufficiency realm that this court did not grant. But in that case, and if you could just give me one sec, it is the same theory that our theory was the, at that time for that issue, was the theory that the Air Force court adopted, if I could just find it real quick. About the change of wing commanders, the Air Force Court said, on this point, we note that subsequent commanders are not required to specifically ratify or adopt standing orders or policies of their predecessors. And there they cited to a United States v. Brown, which was a Air Force case from 1992.
Counsel,
I guess what I'm just asking is if we appear to impute the policy of the prior wing commander to the subsequent wing commander that actually preferred charges in this case, what do we do the same thing with the SJA's advice letter? Do we impute that to him also?
Not necessarily. No, not at all.
Why not, counsel? If you have, let's assume, and this is not what this memo says, but if the letter from the SJA said, in effect, here's a subterfuge, and that's now the policy that's established. The fact that the subsequent commander doesn't know about that, does that mean that we ignore the original letter that led to the policy?
Correct, and I think I misspoke. What the commander had in place when he got in is, you know, how that got in place, I think it's still close to him.
Now, with respect to the... Did you have further questions, Judge Ryan? With respect to the memo here, if the SJA had said, in order to ensure that airmen are ready to perform their duties, once an airman turns positive on a urinalysis, it's lawful and appropriate to continue to test all airmen who are in that position and give them an inspection until they no longer show positive. That may have been a valid inspection. This memo doesn't say that.
Correct.
Where is that theory at all set forth in this case? I understand and have read the memo about general language about good order, discipline, health, fitness, etc. But where does the commander or anyone say here why they are testing these particular individuals?
I believe that's in the policy letter. And in the policy letter, he states that the policy was to ensure security, military fitness, and good order and discipline. And he says that drug use has the potential to seriously undermine our mission, endanger the lives of other members, and negatively impact the nation's
security. And that's nowhere in the memo that comes from the staff judge advocate.
That's correct.
How do we deal with that? This is not a case in which the commander comes to the staff judge advocate with a problem and they're brainstorming about something to do. This is a staff judge advocate who puts together a program and says, we're going to do the program for X. And then the commander puts out a memo that says, we're going to do it for Y. And there's no indication here that the commander applied any original thought to this particular problem. That is, the commander here is implementing something that the staff judging advocate has brought to him. Is it necessary that we find that the commander is a mere puppet in that situation?
I don't believe so in this case because of not only his policy letter, but then the follow-on affidavit.
But I guess my question is, why are they necessarily contradictory? That is, if the commander read the SJA's memorandum, why would he regard that as being contradictory to the memorandum that he put out? Why couldn't he see it as being consistent? That is, one of the ways we're going to maintain good order and discipline is to make sure that we got a good second year analysis so we can prosecute people. Why would a commander find that to be at all inconsistent?
Well, in terms of, and we're talking about purposes here.
Right. What is inconsistent about prosecuting people in a military justice system with maintaining good order and discipline?
I mean, the government's never said that these are, on the face inconsistent.
So if they're not inconsistent, if the commander looked at this memo and said, yeah, that sounds good to me, and I'll sign the other one too, why would his subsequent affidavit necessarily clear anything up?
Well, the point is, I mean, what that SJA memo gives is plenty of secondary purposes that are correct. That are valid, secondary purposes that are allowed. UCMJ action can flow from this, and the case law is very clear on that. But the point is the primary purpose. So here we've got a commander who states multiple times, here's my primary purpose, and we know that he's also seen the secondary purposes as well, because in the policy letter it says this is being used, and this is being used as a continuation of the original random year analysis. It's not a criminal investigative tool, regardless of the admissibility of such tests as evidence in the UCMJ. So it's clear that he knows, and this is kind of like in Jackson talking about the candor, and obviously if we're not going to stand here and say the commander was oblivious to what he could use these results for. That goes back to Jackson with candor to the command, becoming candor and that part of it. But the point is, what he says is, regardless of whether I can use it for these secondary purposes, what I'm using it for is to make sure that my unit is secure.
What does the record establish as to what assignment this individual was given, the appellant was given, after he had a positive year analysis? Was he out on the flight line?
I'm not aware.
Was he performing any military duties other than being in a holding company awaiting court-martial prosecution?
I'm not sure of that.
Okay.
I mean, in discussing candor, does it cut for or against candor that this letter from the commander basically mouths much of the language of the pickle?
In terms of
what's the likelihood that a wing commander read United States versus pickle?
Well, the point being, and the SJA memo cites pickle. But the language that's in there is from 313B. So the point is not that he totally disregarded this SJA memo. That is not our contention at all. The contention is, yes, SJA, I see the purposes that you've given me, but my primary purpose is this. And he stated that in the policy, and then he stated it in a signed, sworn affidavit that once again wasn't refuted by the appellant at trial. And once again, what we're looking at here is a clearly erroneous standard, because the primary purpose is a finding of fact. So we've got to look at it under a clearly erroneous standard. And what the military judge was given, and this is even after he used a clear and convincing standard for the preponderance of evidence, when he really only had to use the burden of proof as opposed to when he only had to use a preponderance of evidence. So he's using the higher level of clear and convincing evidence and still find that the primary purpose of the policy was permissible under 313B. And I would just note fairly quickly, the appellant's counsel stated that he used that the sole purpose was the finding of fact. But looking at on Joint Appendix appendix, page 20, in his findings, the judge says, 17, I conclude the primary purpose of both the urinalysis inspection and the urinalysis reinspection is to ensure the security, military fitness, and good order and discipline of the 355th Wing. So, he found that the primary purpose was for a valid reason. So this court has got to look at that under a clearly erroneous standard, and there is just no evidence there that his finding was clearly erroneous.
That's an interesting question. In terms of the standard of 313, does that 17 become a finding of fact or a conclusion of law? Because is there anything left to conclude in law once you make that statement that's made in 17?
Absolutely. I believe there is. You know, there's plenty of other things that if you find that, you know, the primary purpose of a search is valid, other things can go wrong that can change an inspection into a search. And there's a case law about that in terms of going outside the scope of the inspection, transforming the inspection into a search after the fact because of new evidence that comes up. But the only thing at issue in this case that the appellant has brought up is the primary purpose. So, you know, him finding the primary purpose was, as a finding of fact, was valid, makes it a finding, like I said, makes it a finding of fact that is reviewed at a clearly erroneous standard.
Unless there are any other questions, we have the opportunity to briefly conclude.
Like I said, this boils down to a clear policy given by a seasoned Air Force commander and an uncontroverted affidavit presented by the government at trial from that commander. The military judge's findings of fact regarding the commander's valid primary purpose was not clearly erroneous, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the appellant's motion to suppress, as the military judge properly found the primary purpose valid under MRE 313B. And holding that evidence in the light most favorable to the government, the United States respectfully requests you affirm the findings and sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. Kind of piggyback on some of those questions that this court was directing towards government counsel. When you have a situation like this where kind of you're looking at the language where one's describing a search, one's describing an inspection, meaning the policy letter and the SGA's memorandum, it lends itself to think there was something more that happened as far as a discussion. And when the SGA comes in with such strong language talking about how this should be used for prosecutorial purposes, it does then lend, I think, to the line of thinking of what you were saying, Judge Efron.
Asking questions.
Excuse, I'm sorry?
I was asking questions.
Yeah, but as far as your question about was this commander, when he said good order and discipline, tying it to the prosecutorial purpose that the SJA put in his memorandum, quite frankly, it's not kind of the place or kind of where we're taking a look at this. Is this kind of a lipstick on a pig situation where we're using this commander's memorandum, we're using his affidavit to clean up the whole purpose and the whole reasons why his SJA came to him?
Was there anything that kept the defense from calling the SJA on the motion?
No, and that goes back to the candor that I raised with the court earlier, that the defense counsel certainly could have developed the trial record a little bit more completely in a situation like this, whereas that's where when you're dealing with a constitutional issue and an issue of search of the Fourth Amendment, should we be accepting these conclusory conclusions or statements from a wing commander who signed an affidavit? There was approximately 18 months that lapsed, so there was some period of time. He's retired, so some memories fade over time, and that all he did was parrot back the language in his policy memorandum, in the affidavit, and he did nothing to address, even though he knew why his policy was being challenged, there was nothing to address how he implemented it and why it was for a different purpose other than what his SJA proposed to him. And it kind of goes to, Taylor looked and examined Franks v. Delaware. If a deliberate misstatement can void a warrant, why can't a deliberate misstatement and deliberate misadvice from a staff judge advocate void an inspection, which is the situation that we have here? Because what we have is a SJA who most definitely misadvised his commander, used very strong language as to the reasons he wanted this policy in place when he was the one approaching the commander. And in fact, when he goes and he makes his conclusions in his last paragraph of his memorandum, You know, it's interesting that the case law quite frequently says we want to detect and deter when discussing why we're doing this for the mission purposes or for the security of a unit. This SJA couldn't even say that. He simply said, I recommend you establish this policy because it's to further aid in detecting drug abusers, potentially decreasing litigation risk and costs, and potentially aid in swifter judicial action. And that's the left line. Last lines left with this particular commander as he went to this policy. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation. The case is submitted. The court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.